We ask now for your careful, your prayerful attention to our brother Glenn as he brings to us the message this evening.
Thank you, Don, and good evening, everyone. Tonight I do have a message that I'd like to deliver, and it's something I've learned myself as I've had the opportunity as the adult Sunday school teacher to try to figure out Isaiah and the responsibility to look at some prophetic statements and try to figure out what they're talking about. I've learned a few things. And I have, in learning that, I've made a comparison to some of the things other brothers have found in various other studies of Scripture, and I found kind of a common theme, or not a theme, but a characteristic, if you will. And so tonight, I would like to try to relate that to you. And so tonight's topic is going to be mostly kind of about prophetical writing, but it really has some applications in Scripture as a whole. Now, I don't want anyone to get some false expectations and be disappointed tonight. I'm not going to give some prophecy and some new insight or understanding or new some concept about it, but rather maybe to understand the nature of it a little bit and the way we think about it and the way we look at prophecy as a tool to help us to understand. Because I found myself, as I've looked at some of these things, that I have some preconceived ideas or notions that actually hinder my ability to really understand it. Because sometimes when we get this idea in our mind of how things should be or are, it's hard to get outside of that and see the truth when that what we're expecting isn't really the course of path that we should be on. And so tonight, I'd like to help us to kind of maybe get outside of the way we've kind of looked at that, that maybe some of these things won't be quite as challenging to us to understand, because I believe we're in a time where a lot of these things we're going to start to have a little better understanding. I believe we've seen it already. We have several brothers who've done some various studies on things that have troubled mankind since they were written, and certainly the church for quite some time. Understanding of Revelation and some of the writings in Daniel and the different things, I believe we're starting to get a little bit better of a handle, understanding what they are and our role and where we fit in those. And so tonight what I'd like to do is first, I'm going to read a few scriptures that are prophetic in nature. Now, I'm going to point out a few things there, and then the idea that I really want to present is relatively simple, but I think it's going to be hard to really get an application. And so what I've decided to do is the second part, I'm going to step outside of Scripture. We're going to spend probably the most part tonight looking at some history. And I'm going to try to find something, keep it kind of interesting, I hope, and find some things that are a little more easy for us to grasp, things that are a little bit closer to our understanding. And then having done that, I'm going to try to make a comparison and try to bring those together and make an application to kind of trying to understand some of these prophetic ways of writing. And it has an application of Scripture as a whole. And so that's kind of the plan for this evening. And hopefully it'll work. And hopefully you'll find something out of it, find it kind of interesting and keep your attention here. I do have a few scriptures I'm going to start with. I have them already printed out here. They're just portions of things. I'm not going to go them in depth because I just want to point out a few things. They're ones we're familiar with. And because I got them printed, I'll probably be long done before I get to them. So I'm recommending you don't even try to follow along. Just kind of listen to them here because I'm not even going the whole thing. I just want to point out a few things. The first one I want to start with is in Daniel. And it's Daniel 7th chapter, verses 1 through 7. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. And then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. Daniel spake and said, I saw my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heavens strove upon the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion, had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. And the beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And the vision goes on. That's not complete. I just want to kind of try to get that image in your head there. And then I want to jump over to Ezekiel. In the first chapter, I'm going to start with verse 5 and read through verse 10. Also out of the midst thereof came likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man, and every one had four faces, and every one had four wings, and their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot. And they sparkled like the color of burnished brass. And they had the hands of a man under their wings on their four sides, and they four had faces in their wings. Their wings were joined one to another, and they turned not when they went, and they went every one straight forward. As for the likeness of their faces, they four had the face of a man and the face of a lion, and on the right side they four had the face of an ox, and on the left side they four also had the face of an eagle. And again, this continues. This isn't the complete vision. And I'd like to jump over here in Revelation, the 12th chapter, verse 1. And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head 12 stars. And again, that vision continues on. But as I've read those, there have been many of those who, in our midst here, who have gone to great length to try to study those and try to explain what those are referring to, what they're symbolic in nature of and what their references are to. There's numerous commentaries, some of them we would believe, you know, way off base, but there's numerous resources that you can look at to try to get some ideas. Not all of them are too far off. But there's certainly a lot of resources that you can use to try to figure what they're talking about here. But I would like you to think, if you didn't have those, no one's ever told you anything at all about any of these prophetic statements, these prophetic visions and stuff, and you're just a sit down, you're trying to read them for the first time and figure out what it means. You probably read through there, you get done with it, and you say, huh? This is scripture. This is prophecy. This is supposed to be applying to me. Why are they writing like this? You know, how am I supposed to understand this? You know, is this some little secret, little combination that only a select few are going to have the ability to understand? I'm going to be dependent upon these individuals to figure it out for me? I mean, on its own, if you're just to sit down and read it without any other resources, without someone to talk about, without some background and stuff, you know, this is, at best, confusing. And because of that, its nature, I think sometimes we look at it, and it makes us, because we don't understand the reasons behind it, and the nature or the style of these writings, it tends to hinder us because we expect it to be more difficult. We expect it to be something aside from what it really is. And so tonight, my endeavor is to help us maybe to understand a little bit more the reason why it is that way, or at least what I believe is a portion. This isn't going to be complete in any instance, but just a little portion of it that I think sometimes is a stumbling block to us. Now, in order to do that, I could just say, well, it's because of, which I am at the end, but I'm not going to right now, but I could just, well, it's because, and I could, in two or three sentences, I could sum this up, and I could sit down, some people would be very happy, but I don't think you'd really kind of grasp it. And so I'm going to try to use another example that maybe is a little bit easier for us to grasp, because it's things we're more familiar with. And that example I'm going to use, I'm going to apologize to some people because I realize that there are some who have made a very adamant stand, if you will, as far as, you know, viewing of movies and things. And the example I'm going to use here is a movie. And if I apologize if this is something that, you know, really bothers you, but I think it's common enough that even if you haven't seen it, it's a pretty common reference that everyone's pretty well familiar with. And that movie is The Wizard of Oz. It originally is a movie. It came out in 1939. And there's been several takeoffs. I mean, there's some Broadway films or Broadway shows that have been put on. There's been numerous, you know, takeoffs around. In 1978, there's one that's entitled The Wiz. It starred Diana Ross and Michael Jackson. Now, I haven't seen it. If someone here has seen it and I'm way off base, you know, feel free to correct me because I'm just going on what people, some things I read about it. But supposedly, I mean, it's kind of a takeoff. It has the same characters like the Wizard of Oz, but it's portraying, you know, the plight of black inner city dwellers and their desire to come out of the poor conditions they're in and to go on to something better, much like, you know, Dorothy, you know, she's in Kansas and dreaming of something, you know, out and beyond, you know, where she's at and stuff. And although they're the same characters, a similar theme, it's really quite different. And if you're not familiar with the original movie, if all you ever went and saw The Wiz, you'd probably not really understand the original concept from the movie, The Wizard of Oz. But where did The Wizard of Oz come from? The Wizard of Oz came from a book, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz by L. Frank Baum, that was published in 1900. And I think there's something interesting in there that hopefully I can use to make a point this night. To understand this book, we have to understand some history. Because I'll tell you, I'll give you a little hint. The Wizard of Oz is much more than just a fun little movie for entertainment. Well, the movie probably is made for entertainment, but the book was more than just something for entertainment. But before I go on that, we need to understand the history a little bit, what was going on around the late 1800s, up to the turn of the century. Now, I will tell you right now, in this short time frame, I cannot go in great detail to make everyone have this complete understanding of all the ramifications and all the things that are going on. So those of you that know quite a bit about history know I'm going to leave a lot of things out, and I can't put enough pieces here to give a real clear picture. And for those of you who aren't big history buffs, you know, you may come away with some misconceptions as far as what's going on because I don't have time to really give everything. I'll give her bits and pieces. I can't paint you a big picture. They have whole history, you know, whole classes on history. They'll take time to do this, and I can't do it in the short time I have here. But there are some important things that that we need to understand. And to understand that, we need to know that in the late 1800s, the United States was in what was termed at that time the Great Depression. Like World War I, when it happened, wasn't called World War I, it's called the Great War because they didn't know there was going to be another one. It was the Great Depression because they didn't know there was going to be a worse one in the 1930s. But nonetheless, economically, it was a very trying time here in the United States. At this particular time, we're in the midst of the Industrial Revolution. Manufacturing is increasing, factories are going up, manufacturing, you know, mills, all these different things. More and more people are moving from a rural type of life and in the farmlands, they're moving to the cities. The cities are growing. And as these companies are starting to make a lot of money, they're putting more and more demands upon their workers. They're working unbelievably long hours. It wasn't uncommon, the expectation of 14, 16, 18 hours a day work. Very unsafe conditions. People lost their lives, they lost limbs, body parts, and some of this machinery with no real thought for safety. Pay was, in most cases, very poor. Because of that, there were unions, or the forerunners of unions, that were trying to be formed at this time. At this particular time, though, the government and courts were upholding the rights of employers to break them up, by force if necessary, to compel workers to go back to work. This was a time where with this industrial prosperity, huge trusts and monopolies were growing. Individuals were making tremendous wealth and having that for great control of things. During this time was when Rockefeller and Standard Oil were probably the biggest power in the United States, or maybe in the world at that time. During this same time, Europe, and primarily Great Britain, also in an industrial revolution, also growing and expanding and stuff, they were buying larger and larger quantities of their products from the Orient. And the Orient was expecting their payment in gold, primarily gold-backed finances. And because of that, Europe was becoming very depleted on gold. It's been going up in value. There's less and less of it because the Orient wasn't buying corresponding parts. So although products are going into Europe, they're backing for it, their gold and their and the things they're backing, their financial things, are going into the Orient. And because of that, particularly Great Britain and much of Europe, they're expecting their people that they have contact with, they sell products, to be backing their things under gold. And so much of the industry in the United States at this time was in the east, along the northern section along the coast, and coming in from the coast a little bit. And as such, most of the gold was being attributed there, and most of that was flowing in into Europe for the products that they were purchasing, and gold was becoming more and more valuable. At the same time, after the Civil War, the Civil War being primarily most of their money being backed by silver, there was a huge influx into the north from silver that came from the south that at really no expense other than the war, which is pretty major, but as far as a business thing, there's a huge influx of silver, and the price of silver was just plummeting in relation to the price of gold. At this particular time, there was no federal authority over banks. Banks pretty well set rates, interest rates they want, the value of dollars, and they usually did it to their best interest that they could make profit. The United States wasn't on a gold standard, and I don't have a whole time to go explain all that. It's a very complex thing. But nonetheless, there were loans and monetary things, whether dollars or coinage, that are being backed by silver. Banks were not having any problem still making loans backed on silver, but at this particular time, they were refusing to take payment in silver, demanding payment in gold. So an individual, such a farmer, might take out his loan and get him money for everything backed on silver. It comes time to make his payment, and the bank says, well, I don't. This is silver-backed. We aren't taking that. You have to have gold-backed, supported payment. Everyone around is getting money from the bank back based on silver, and now the gold's expecting gold, or the banks are expecting repayment on gold-supported finances. Because of this, many farmers were losing their farms. Not that they didn't have some resource, they have silver, but the banks won't take it for payment. Probably because they wanted the farms because railroads were coming through and they're going to pay a whole lot more for the property than they sold and the farmers bought it for. Another key issue is, you know, farmers as a whole were very rural. They're isolated. I mean, they'd have their little chunk of land. They'd work their farm. For the most part, they might only get into, you know, a small town occasionally for supplies and stuff. And so they wouldn't know a lot of the news that's going on. They wouldn't have a lot of tremendous support and things. They're very isolated. One of the key issues in the 1896 presidential election was trying to correct this imbalance between gold and silver, and the big political cry in 1896 was 16 to 1 for a standard that 16 ounces of gold would always have the same value of 1 ounce of gold, that there would always be a relation. When the price of gold went up, so would silver, and that there would always be this relationship. This was a time, because of all these concerns, all these workers in factories and farmers and the depression and people out of employment and all these things going on, that there was a boom of new political parties. They're trying to address these issues come up. Most of them have long since disappeared. One of the more bigger one at the times was the Populist Party. You don't hear them too much, but they kind of merged in. And between their views and the relatively new Democratic Party at that time is during this time that really the Democratic Party established its platform or its beliefs or its principles that much carries through today. Much of that, those of you that know a lot about history, was under kind of the battle cry, if you will, of William Jennings Bryan, who promoted a lot of these things for the average person. Whether his answers or his solutions really would have fixed it or not, Nonetheless, that was what his cry was for the common man. He's called the great commoner because he was trying to advocate for things, for rights for workers and these farmers and everything that was losing everything, that they had no control or resources to be able to address them. So that's just kind of a short overview of what was going on at the time. So what does this have to do with the book, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz? Well, during that time, as continues today, any political thing, there's commentaries, and at that time, there were political cartoonists, too, that were trying to address these things that are going on around them. A very common series, two series that were very common, they were nationally published in newspapers across America at that time, where one was Puck and the other was Judge. And between these two, they had some common things that they used over and over to symbolize the things that were going on in America. One of those was a cyclone, which represented the political revolution, or the change, a political revolution that was coming in America with these new parties and these demands for these rights and different things. Another common thing was a scarecrow, which was representative of the farmers and the rural communities. Another one was a Tin Man. You're probably starting to see the similarities there, aren't you? The Tin Man was representative of the industrial workers. Munchkins, little people, and that's what they were called. They're referred to in the political thing. The Munchkins were the city dwellers. They had a lion that represented both McKinley and Cleveland. And to understand this, these were major things, but McKinley and Cleveland both refused to take any one side or the other in the gold standard issue because the nation was divided, and no matter which side they took, it would cost them votes. The labor issues, they refused to do things, and they were depicted as being cowardly. They're supposed to be a lion, they're supposed to be in charge, but they wouldn't take up the issue because of it. Monkeys were depicting politicians. Witches were the power brokers of the time. Now, as The Wiz differed somewhat from the movie The Wizard of Oz, so The Wizard of Oz differed somewhat from the book, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Probably most of you are here familiar with the movie. But I'd like to look at the book a little bit, because it's a little bit different. First off is the title. The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Oz, O-Z. The abbreviation for ounce. The whole thing is about this uproar over, and we'll get that, you'll probably see the Yellow Brick Road, the gold standard, and something that kind of got changed in the movie, kind of takes away from it. But O-Z, Oz, is the abbreviation for ounce. Dorothy, the average American, simple, desiring something better for her life. There was another political cartoon at the time, not part of those two series, but it was commonplace that had a character that looked almost identical to the Dorothy of the book because the book was illustrated. So we're not talking about Judy Garland here, but I'm talking in the book was illustrated, and the Dorothy in that book looked almost identical to the Dorothy in this other political cartoon. Despite being naive, those of you who remember the story, she's caught up in the cyclone, whether she wants to be or not. The world around her is going to change. This cyclone, this political force, kills the Wicked Witch of the East. The East, where the industrial power brokers were at this time, was under this threat, losing a lot of their clout and stuff. There's more support with these unions. These trusts are beginning to break up. And so these powers in the East are beginning to be broke up. As such, in the East had the control over the major cities at the time. Then it was the West. We now call it the Midwest because we hadn't quite expanded out as much as we are now from coast to coast. But at that point, you know, they're mostly in the city and they had a lot of control of what's going on in the cities. And it kind of, remember in the movie and also in the book, with the death of the Wicked Witch of the East, it kind of freed up the Munchkins, the average people, to be more active politically. Because they're actually, at the time, businesses, they're having elections. If the owner of the company either was supporting something that's going up in an election or opposing it, he'd either allow his employees off or he'd fire them if they went. They didn't have laws that forced employers to allow people to have time to vote. And so with the breaking of some of these powers, it gave the individual in the city a lot more political clout to be able to vote and to be heard. With the death of the Wicked Witch of the East, though, there's this power in the West that's still a threat. Where the transition went to the farmers of the Midwest and the Good Witch. The Good Witch of the North tells Dorothy that the Wicked Witch of the West is far worse, more evil than her sister from the East. We find that the Wicked Witch of the East is destroyed by a cyclone, political forces, the breaking up of the unions and the trusts and things are going on. The Wicked Witch of the West is destroyed by water. And ultimately that is what was holding back the farmers. When they got in a drought and they didn't have water, they were at the hands and the mercy of the banks. If they would have water, they wouldn't be in the situations they're in. They could sell their crops and they'd be able to pay these things. So water was a very crucial thing in that. I'll talk about that a little bit more about that a little bit later. With the death of the Witch of the East, or I talked a little bit about that, the good witches of the North and South. Primarily the North and the Northwest and the extreme South were the sources of these political activists that made the Populist Party and started these things going. William Jennings Bryan was from Nebraska. And they're the ones trying to make these big political changes. The Scarecrow, rural America. Remember, he's trapped on a pole. Unorganized, you know. The rural workers of America, you know, by distance and stuff, they didn't know what's going on. They didn't get the paper all the time. They didn't know the things that were going on. In order to stand up to these opposing forces, they needed to be organized. They needed a brain. They had to work together for irrigation, to build things, to work one with another, and so that they have things like water, the things they needed that they'd be able to stand and be firm. The Tin Man, in the political cartoons, he represents the industrial workers. In the book, which goes in more detail than we see in the movie, you know, he keeps cutting off parts of them. He starts as a man, but he keeps replacing himself with tin things. So eventually he's a tin man. He's rusted, he can't move because he doesn't have oil. Symbolizing the dehumanization of the industrial workers at the time, who were bound by Standard Oil. They couldn't move without it. But the real concern is that they can't survive if this dehumanization continues. They need a heart. They need to be treated like a living human being. In the book, it doesn't get developed so much in the movie. In the book, the Scarecrow and the Tin Man must work constantly together to help accomplish this task that they're going to take upon themselves. As many of the political activists of the time realized that the labor and the farm unions were going to have to work together against the power brokers, or else they just keep flipping back and forth. Because as soon as they got a lot of the things started in the industrial thing, everything switched to the rural communities. Unless the two work together, they just keep flipping back and forth. In the book, Dorothy has silver slippers. It is changed to ruby in the movie, but the value of silver. Things they had, they were in their possession, and the banks were wanting to tell them it was of no value, but if they would hold on to it and keep up their fight, you know, eventually it'd bring them back home to what they're trying to desire to obtain. So she had to keep on to those. She couldn't discard those silver slippers. The lion. Turns out there'll really be no help all along. They have to keep moving him along. The lion, you expect to be this fierce and courageous thing, is no help. Because he needs courage. Although some believe that really this is referring to William Jennings Bryan because he lost his bid for president in 1896 and again in 1900, I don't believe he ever lacked courage because he always continued in his convictions. And it's not in tune with what the political cartoons of the time are showing, and all these others fit in with that. So I believe it's talking about Presidents Cleveland and McKinley, who refused to address these issues during their presidencies, during their campaigns. Monkeys are the politicians, and actually are the powers that were found, you know, with the corruption and everything, to be pawns of these power brokers, just like in the movie. They're constantly there trying to support the witch and her work to get these things, to deter Dorothy, these individuals that are trying to accomplish things. In the book, Emerald City is white. Why do you call it Emerald City? Because all the residents wear green glasses and believe the city's green. Believe that it's representative of the White House government and the fallacy that the money that they were issuing green had any value. When the reality at that time, I mean, everything was in the control of the banks. The government money may have this value this day, and the next day it's worth that, and there was nothing consistent. There wasn't anything you could count on. Banks were printing money as well as the government. Not just the government printed money. And so the government really had no control, but they were given this fallacy that, you know, you have this money and this idea, but in reality, it's all an illusion. The wizard, I'm not going to spend a lot of time, I mean, the controlling all these things, it turns out really be fake. It's all to give an illusion and to create and maintain what he has there, the power brokers of the time. At the particular time, for those who are of this political mindset of trying to make this big change, the Populist Party and some of the changes that came in the Democratic Party at that time, they weren't faring well in the elections. And a lot of it because in these industrial bases, employers refused to let them go to elections that would help them have the votes they needed. But they had a hope of a courageous politician from New York. They couldn't get him to get the political, they couldn't get him to get the presidential nomination they wanted, but they hoped that they could get him in through the back door. Back door, come in backwards, if you will, still get him in a position. And so they managed to get him on as vice president on the ticket for the next election, in which he was elected, and that was Theodore Roosevelt. With the assassination of McKinley, he became president, and he, whether you agree with what he did or not, he was no political coward. And he took these issues and made decisions on them. With him, there were compromises. Trade unions gained strength. Employees got rights. Monopolies were broken. Trusts were broken up. Federal standards were set. He kind of came in backwards. They didn't expect him to be president. They were hoping to get him as vice president. And many believe that that is symbolic of the fact that Dorothy are the symbols backwards of Theodore. And as we go through that, there's many other perils. You know, Aunt M has a meaning, Toto and stuff. I'm not going to go into a lot of that. But there's a lot more in that book. And Baum was a political activist. He was a populist. He supported those ideas. He did a whole series of Oz books with women's suffrage, with the same thing, symbolic things, women's suffrage, civil rights for the blacks, and a whole lot of other things he did. And so this wasn't something unique, and it wasn't something hidden. Hopefully you found that interesting. Maybe you didn't know that. But what does that mean? I mean, what does that have? What application is that going to have to me? Well, I'd like you to consider those things, and consider, if you will, a little parallel here. The Wiz, a more recent production. In many ways, I'm going to liken to the modern translations of the Bible. They carry a shadow of the former, but they're so distant you don't get the foundation. Certainly, if you saw the movie The Wiz, you'd be hard to get up all the things that came from the movie The Wizard of Oz and would never get back to the book. Individuals that follow these things, you know, they know of Christ, they know of salvation. But it's so distorted, they get these false beliefs like the rapture, once saved, always saved, these other things that come in. In many ways, I'm going to liken us to what we have as being like the movie, The Wizard of Oz. There is enough retained there that we have a pretty good idea of what they're talking about. You know, we look through particularly the Bible, some of these scriptures, you know, we have a pretty good idea of what they're talking about. But, you know, it's not exact. There are some differences. You know, in our study of Isaiah, we're finding that where Isaiah was quoted in the Book of Mormon, there are places where there are some substantial differences that really change the whole thing, or you lose a whole grasp of it. Kind of like Dorothy, you know, having ruby slippers instead of silver slippers. In the book, that was very significant. But like, if we just see the movie and we don't understand the conditions, we will never get the message. Anyone that wasn't aware, that's, you know, late teens, an adult, who is, you know, reading newspapers, who knows anything at all that's going on at the time in 1900, when the book came out, would immediately recognize that this was more than just a little fun little book. They'd see the cyclone, the scarecrow, the tin man, and they would know, even if they didn't grasp all the little implications, they would look at that and say, you know, this guy's saying something. He's making a comment on it. Just like the political cartoons, you know, use exaggerations and symbolism to represent things, he was doing the same thing with words. So by the time the movie came out in 1939, if you had to be, you know, your late teens or at least adult to really be fathoming what's going on, by the time, you know, some 40 years later, you'd really have to be, you know, probably 55 or older when the movie came out to really even have any remembrance of when the book came out or the things that were happening politically in America at that time. And so how do I want to apply this? Well, here's my concern. Something that I found in myself, and I believe that probably many of us, we think without even realizing it, is when we look at prophetical writings in the Bible, we look at them and we look at them and we think of them as something mysterious, something that's secretive. We look at it like a foreign language. And because of that, we naturally think that there is something in the way of us really understanding it. And if we think there's something in the way of us understanding, we probably will allow that to accomplish that it doesn't happen. But rather, I'd like us to consider things a little bit different than maybe very well when these things were written, they were not secretive, but in the culture and the environment and the things that are going on, they were very well known. That someone, whether they agreed with it or not, just like the Wizard of Oz, you didn't have to agree with it to recognize what the author is saying, someone living at the time and stuff would very well recognize what is being spoken of. The wonderful Wizard of Oz was written was very obvious to the individuals around it. How many, I like to show of hands, how many here knew any of this about the Wizard of Oz before I said anything tonight? Zero. With time, you know, we don't understand the circumstances. We don't understand the examples that are being used. We don't understand the symbolism of the time. And we don't get the message. Because we don't understand the culture. We don't understand the examples. We don't understand the styles and the mannerisms of the time. And so the message that I would like to give tonight, this was, I could sum it up real quick with this basically one sentence. But if I just said that and sat down, probably meant I hope I haven't wasted my time, that no one really have kind of the grasp of what I'm trying to say, like this example. The message, I believe, is really the secret to understanding the prophecy of the future is understanding the history of the past. You know, as we've learned, and particularly in our Sunday school class, and many others, our brother Don did a thing a while back, you know, chiasmus is a way of writing. But until it was recognized, we didn't understand that. And yet, it's in there, and frequently when you look, you read through Scripture and stuff, it seems like, they just wrote the same thing here like two verses before. Why are they repeating themselves? You know, I mean, because we didn't understand it's a style. And really, those of you who aren't familiar, hopefully most of you are, you know, this chiasmus, this repeated reverse order, kind of like this big V. And you don't see it until you get to the point where the words are being repeated very close together. When you get all this concept and you just read it two verses before, and you start backing up, and pretty soon you see a concept from eight chapters before now being repeated. And that part isn't as obvious. but it helps you to understand. This is why it's being repeated. This is a style of writing. And usually there's an importance to the sequence. It usually pointing to the important theme. You know, our brother and our apostle, Don McIndoe, he did this a while back, and I believe he's probably still working on it, you know, did this wonderful study on the book of Revelation. I think everyone who's taken time to try and understand has gained tremendously from it, but he backed it with history. Understanding what these things meant and the conditions that were going on at the time. Similarly, our brother Brian McIndoe did a similar thing on the rapture and how this came to be. And once again, it's filled with history of the circumstances that allowed this change from a belief that once was to come in. So the point I really want to try to make tonight is that, you know, Scripture, particularly prophecy, really may not be that secretive. It's just with time passing, we don't understand it. The book, when it was written, may not have been with the intent that it would be hard to understand or that it would be secretive. But without understanding what was going on at the time and understanding the common practices, it makes us some 2,000 years, 3,000 years, four, some of these older prophets, might not four, but you know, 2,000 or 3,000 years past, so difficult to understand when you consider this within this example within The Wizard of Oz, you know, three writings between the book, the movie, and then the next movie, and only 100, maybe 100 plus a few years separated. No one here remembers anything about those or knew what was going on. And so my challenge this night is to not be fearful of history. And particularly our young people that you're still in school. Because a lot of the stuff, it's easy to tune off because you're going to hear things contrary to Scripture. You're going to hear evolution rather than creation. You're going to hear a lot of things. But be attentive to some of those studies of ancient lands and ancient people because you may be the person that picks up the understanding to help understand what was a custom or a practice to help understand some of these things. Because even in a short time span between the time Isaiah wrote his words is approximately a little bit less than 100 years before Lehi and his family were going to leave Jerusalem, we find them over here on this land and we find Nephi explaining just less than a century after they're written, how difficult Isaiah was to understand, but he did because of something. And I want you, those who want to desire to follow along, I'm going to read here in 2 Nephi, the 11th chapter. Because Nephi has just been talking about, for the previous chapters, chapters 2 through 14 in Isaiah. And I'm not going to read the whole thing here, but in 2 Nephi, chapter 11, verse 2, he says, "For behold, Isaiah spake many things which were hard for many of my people to understand, for they know not concerning the manner of prophesying among the Jews." You know, we've talked about this a lot in Sunday school, but there is a manner and there is a style that we find is consistent in prophetic writings. And I want to jump down here into verses 8 and 9. It says, "Yea, and my soul delighteth in the words of Isaiah, for I came out of Jerusalem. Mine eyes hath beheld the things of the Jews, and I know that the Jews do understand the things of the prophet, and there is none other people that understand the things which were spoken unto the Jews like unto them, save it be they that are taught after the manner of the things of the Jews. But behold, I, Nephi, have not taught my children after the manner of Jews, but behold, I of myself have dwelt in Jerusalem, wherefore I know concerning the regions round about." He said, you know, it was difficult to understand. It's difficult to understand because they don't understand the manner. They don't understand the conditions. And he said, you know, I do because I was there. I have seen these things. I know the regions about. I know the things that Isaiah is talking about. And as I have tried to endeavor to figure these things out, and as I look at works other brothers have done and stuff, I find, you know, the secret to unlocking a lot of these prophecies is understanding the history and the culture and the things that they were at the time. And so I'd like, my endeavor tonight is maybe break down this mental block sometimes we put up of thinking that, oh, this is some secret little thing that was given to the prophets and only someone who has some great and special wonderful gift or someone in the ministry is going to be able to figure it out. although it may apply in some cases, a lot of these saints were finding that there is a consistency in the way they write. It was not unique. We find many of the prophets use the style of the chiasmus, and some you've noticed there was a similarity in the way both Ezekiel and Daniel describe some of these living beasts and what they were doing. There is a consistency. Maybe, well, a common known thing at the time, a symbolic. Just like when Baum wrote that book, he didn't go out and create a scarecrow. He didn't create the Tin Man and stuff. He used existing things that the people at the time knew and they recognized. And very well may be that when these prophets wrote these things, they used things that had a symbolic reference or importance to the people they're writing, that everyone around there knew what they're talking about. They may not have agreed because we know that they refused to hear those things, but they knew what the prophets were talking about. But with time, we've lost that understanding. Just like with just in a short 100 years, probably very few have understanding this book that came out in 1900 that they then made a movie and everyone thinks is wonderful and entertaining. And then in 1978 or whatever it was, they adapted some more to, you made it modern day, just like the modern day translations of the Bible. So everyone can understand what we're trying to say, but it's drifted so far from what the original thing was, you would never understand it. And so I hope tonight what I've endeavored to do, give you kind of an example. I hopefully kept it kind of interesting, but you can see the parallel. That how quickly, if we don't understand the references, the symbolic nature and stuff, it disappears. And so really, understanding the history is very important. That these things that are written may not be, there's always going to be elements, I believe, because the Lord has certain things that are only going to come out at a certain time, and He doesn't want people to understand. Just like the plates were held for a long time until the Book of Mormon came out. There are things that He does not necessarily want till a certain time, and until that time comes, He's not going to permit an understanding of stuff. But some of the stuff may not really, when it was written, intended to be secretive. Not intended to be hidden, not intended to not be understood, but when we approach it that way, we think that and we stop looking because we think, well, I'm not supposed to understand that. That is something complex, and that may not be the case, but we're just approaching it wrong. And that's why I said, my whole sermon tonight can be summed up in one sentence, what I really like us to understand. Hopefully everything I've done tonight helps us to support it. That I really believe much of what we need to do to understand the prophecy of the future is we have to understand the history of the past. Thank you.